Brothers and sisters, if you don't change your ways, you are on the road to Jam Nation. How can we dance when our earth is turning? How do we sleep while our beds are burning? How can we dance when our earth is turning? How do we sleep while our beds are burning? Welcome back, everybody, to episode 30 of Road to Jam Nation. After my longest and deepest dive into a musical year ever, I finally get to reveal the 20 albums that stood out for me as my own particular favorite albums of 1987. For any new listeners, I'd like to reiterate that when I do these lists, I am strictly speaking of my favorite music. I do not in any way claim to have the necessary educational background to make judgments on what great art is. But I do know what I like, and that's what I tend to present. I will make note when I think something is great art, but I am always willing to admit that these are simply my own opinions. My background is not in liberal arts. I had a Bachelor of Science degree. This current countdown is focused on 1987. For the past five episodes, I've been doing a deep dive into the musical trends and popular genres of music in 1987, covering a large number of albums that did not ultimately make my top 20 list. So if you want to hear more about this year and you're a new listener, you can dial back to episode 25 and start there. Or you can always start at episode 1, where I go over a bit more detail of the background of my countdown projects and some of the self-imposed rules that I put on myself in formulating these lists. So, after those five episodes, we now finally get to start looking at my actual 20 favorite albums. But first off, let me make note of another album that didn't actually make my top 20 list. An album that I did not cover in any of those five previous episodes. My entry music for this episode was the song Beds Are Burning, which was a song that made Australian band Midnight Oiled a so-called one-hit wonder on the American pop charts. By 1987, Midnight Oil were releasing the sixth album of their career, and the band had risen to be one of the most popular bands in their native land of Australia. Midnight Oil had formed in Sydney in 1972, under the name Farm, before changing their name to Midnight Oil in 1976. The band began recording in 1978, but they did not meet with immediate commercial success. The band toured relentlessly, often playing up to 200 shows per year, and they slowly built a loyal cult following in their country. Midnight Oil finally placed a couple of songs low down in the Australian Top 40 with their third album. And they hit the Australian Top 10 with a song off their fourth album. The band's fifth album came out in 1984. And despite the album not containing any new hit songs for the band, their popularity had risen to this point that this album quickly became the first album by the band to hit the top of the Australian album charts. And by this time, Midnight Oil had enough American college radio stations playing the band's music that fifth album also became the group's first album to manage to chart in America, although that chart appearance was only at number 178 on the American Billboard charts. This initial American success was enough to convince the band's label to put a heavy marketing push for their next album. And that next album would be Diesel and Dust, which was released in 1987. With help from the heavy rotation for Midnight Oil's music videos on MTV, the first single that would be on Diesel and Dust was released in late 1986. Don't serve your king. White men listen to the songs we sing. White men came, took everything.
But as I noted, the actual album came out in 1987. That first single off this album was the song The Dead Heart. And The Dead Heart became Midnight Oil's biggest hit of their career in Australia, going to number 4 there. And that song crossed over to the American rock charts, hitting number 11. And it also bubbled under the American pop charts, where it topped out at number 53. The follow-up single was released in 1987, and that single was The Beds Are Burning, which is the song I played to start off this episode. The Beds Are Burning was a top 10 hit in Australia, and it hit the American rock top 10 as well, and it became the band's only song to hit the American top 40 pop charts, eventually rising all the way to number 17. A third song from Diesel and Dust was Dream World, and that was released as a single in 1988, and it also became a minor hit on American rock radio. And Dream World would also be the first song by Midnight Oil to hit the brand new American alternative music chart that was started by Billboard magazine in 1988.
No amount of make-believe can help this heart of mine. Your dream world is just about to end. Your dream world is just about to fall. Your dream world will fall.
Another song off this album was the song Put Down the Weapon, and this song became a minor hit in Australia, but it was never released as a single in America, with their record company figuring that with the gun politics in America, that this song was not destined to be popular here. Diesel and Dust was initially released in America very late in 1987, several months after it had been released in Australia and in England. The initial press run of the album shipped to America was pretty small, given that the group had not really had major success here previously. But as the singles off the album gained traction here, a second, much larger pressing of this album was shipped here in 1988, which is the main reason why, if you look back in history, this album was included on a lot of year-end best-of lists in 1988 in the United States, rather than at the end of 1987. The album just hadn't had enough time in 1987 to make that kind of impression on music critics yet. But once Diesel and Dust did get noticed, it got rave reviews from the major music critics, and it wound up ranking high on many of those year-end lists, and not just for the year. Diesel and Dust would go on to also be highly placed in lists of the best albums of the entire decade. I will say that I myself also very much liked this album at the time when it came out, and I still like it enough that I gave it serious consideration for a spot in my top 20. But ultimately, Diesel and Dust is just an album that I like rather than love, so it did wind up getting cut.
Put down that weapon.
So now we finally start my countdown with my number 20 favorite album of 1987. This album was from The Replacements, and the album was titled Pleased to Meet Me.
Listen, you just know where you're right. I'm losing all.
Pleased to Meet Me was the band's fifth studio album, and it was their first album as a trio, as the band had separated with founding member Bob Stinson over interpersonal issues related to the drug-fueled unreliability of the overall band, as well as creative direction, as Paul Westerberg was increasingly interested in playing more melodically based music, while Stinson wanted to keep playing the more loud punk rock influenced music of the band's early style. Pleased to Meet Me thus wound up being dominated by Paul Westerberg's evolving musical muse, as well as the lyric craft that had already been at the forefront of the band. And these new musical ideas from Paul Westerberg led to experiments like the ragged cocktail jazz of the song Nightclub Jitters.
Hurry now, the sun has gone down to the nightclub jitters. Only thing that scares me is the dark, the nightlife critters. What's the cover, where shall we park? Stay home just once for a lark. They say now, don't be a stranger.
The Replacements went to Memphis for this album, and they completed there their most carefully produced professional recording session to their career to that point, using an experienced producer in Jim Dickinson, a man who had produced the third album by the band Big Star. Big Star had been a huge influence on the Replacements, as is evidenced by the presence of the song Alex Chilton on this album, Alex Chilton being a key member of Big Star. Jim Dickinson gave this album a much fuller and more polished sound than any of the previous Replacements albums had featured, and he included some excellent Memphis horn players for the song Can't Hardly Wait.
Lights that flash in the evening.
The Replacements even attempted to market a music video for the album's first single, The Ledge, but MTV wound up refusing to air The Ledge due to the lyrics of the song being about suicide. However, despite all these attempts at professionalism, Paul Westerberg still had obvious misgivings about quote-unquote selling out, and those misgivings can be felt on songs such as the self-deprecating I Don't Know. All the efforts by the Replacements to make a more commercial sounding album didn't actually result in major success for the band at the time. In the end, Please to Meet Me is a fun and engaging album. It's among the most accessible albums that I could recommend for new listeners to give this band a try. But it managed to do that without completely abandoning the ragged drunken glory of the band's early days. My number 19 favorite album of 1987 was from Indigo Girls, and the album was their debut full-length album, which was titled Strange Fire.
You told me all your secrets, and I filled you up with lies. Now I'm living honestly, because I said goodbye.
I can't go home anymore. I don't want to find out what I left there for.
Scared and I'm not lonely, saving all my money for my breath. I'm not looking for an answer, I'm not asking anyone second guess.
The Indigo Girls, Amy and Emily, had grown up in the Atlanta suburbs, and they went to school together as children, though they were in two separate grades, as they were a year apart. Amy and Emily began performing together during high school, but then they separated, initially going off to different colleges, both of those colleges being out of state. As it turned out, both of these ladies wound up homesick for Georgia, and they both transferred to Emory College, which is in Atlanta. And it was while in Emory College that the two began their career as Indigo Girls in 1985. They soon self-recorded and self-released a debut EP that same year, which they self-titled as Indigo Girls. 2 years later, in 1987, they were able to release a full-length album after being signed to a small Canadian record label. That album, of course, being Strange Fire, which I'm covering here. Strange Fire did get distributed in America, but the little Canadian label didn't have a budget to properly promote the album or to distribute it very well. So the album really received no notice at the time of its release. But it did create a product for the band that was able to convince Russell Carter to become their manager, a position that Russell Carter owns to this very day. With the success of several other folky women in the late 1980s, Russell Carter was able to convince Epic Records to sign the Indigo Girls, leading to the release of their major label debut in 1989. That album was self-titled as simply Indigo Girls, like the band had already done for their self-produced EP. The success of the Indigo Girls album on Epic led to Epic also re-releasing this previous album, Strange Fire. Although the Epic release of this album has the song orders majorly rearranged, and two songs from the original pressing were dropped from that re-release, and a cover of the old hippie anthem Get Together was added to it. So while that re-release version is the one that I personally bought when I first became a fan of this group, it is the original 1987 version of this album that I feel should be considered the legitimate version of this album. And since that version did get officially released in America, even if it was only in small numbers, it does count as a 1987 release under my own self-imposed rules. The overall songwriting on Strange Fire isn't quite as strong as the song cycle that the group would put out on their major label debut a couple of years later. This is no surprise, considering that I think that 1989 album is an absolute masterpiece from start to end. So this album definitely suffers in comparison. But still, the songs on this first album are also very strong, and the songs already feature the duo's stunning vocal harmony interplay, with their harmonies, to me, putting them in the pantheon of harmonic greats, along with groups such as the Everly Brothers or CSN. I really think that they're that good. Indigo Girls' first single had come out in 1985, that single being Crazy Game, which was an Emily song, and the group includes that song on this 1987 album.
Crazy game, I never should have started to play, but now you couldn't tell me away. Love is sweet, sweet baby, so good to you, and so bad, and I fear the situation's clear before my eyes.
The Strange Fire album also contained the excellent first version of Land of Canaan, which was an Amy song. This is a song that the duo would re-record for that major label debut 2 years later.
I'm not your promised land, honey, you know that I'm not. I'm not your promised one. I'm not the land of Canaan, oh, sweetheart. Wherever you are through the sun, I'm lonely tonight. I'm missing you now. I'm wanting your love, and you're giving it out. I'm lonely tonight. I'm lonely tonight.
While Indigo Girls' vocal strength is a hallmark of their sound, it is also the differing musical personalities of Amy and Emily that helps to give such good ebb and flow to their folky song cycles, with Emily generally favoring more introspective songs that were inspired by folk artists such as Joni Mitchell. And this sort of style can be heard on the album's opening song, Make It Easier.
Of greener pastures, though like my garden's what I said. Although I'm working hard at last year, I'm still deep in the red. I am rowing as hard as I can, and they're sailing me up a stream. Always one more step away from the American dream.
And then on the other side, Amy was more inspired by punk rock music, which helped to give her songwriting a bit more loose energy on songs such as Walk Away.
There was too much repetition over and over and over again. You know I passed the point of saying over and over and over again. And all this broken glass you left behind won't let you make it clean. I said walk away.
This album's title song, Strange Fire, was another Amy song, and it's another one of the album's highlights.
This is a message, message overall. Love moves from the inside out. Love never grows tired.
My number 18 favorite album of 1987 is by The Smiths, and the album was Strange Ways Here We Come.
I hate the strain of the pain again. Rush and the push and the land that we stand on is ours. It has been before, so it shall be again. And people who are uglier than you and I, they take what they need.
This album would be the final studio album for The Smiths, and it wasn't my only option for the band for the year. The Smiths actually released three albums in 1987, though one of those albums was not actually eligible for the countdown under my self-enforced rules, since that album wasn't officially released in America until almost a quarter century later. That ineligible album being the compilation album titled The World Won't Listen, The World Won't Listen was a collection of all of the band's singles from 1985 through 1987, along with a few songs that hadn't actually been singles, but had almost been released as singles. The other album by the Smiths that was eligible under my rules was the album Louder Than Bombs. Louder Than Bombs is actually the first album by the Smiths that I myself bought. I'd been aware at that time of the Smiths before this, mostly due to occasionally seeing the band on the 120-minute show on MTV. The amusing dark novelty song Girlfriend in a Coma got regular rotation on 120 Minutes in 1987.
Girlfriend in a coma, I know, it's really serious. There were times when I could have murdered her. But you know, I would hate anything to happen to her. No, I don't want to see her. Do you really think she'll go through?
And I like that song. And I had already long been a fan of the song How Soon Is Now. But I hadn't yet bothered to purposely seek out an album by the Smiths. And then I finally happened to see a copy of Louder Than Bombs in my favorite used record store, Reno's Recycled Records. So I picked it up that day, despite it not having either of those two songs that I was most familiar with. The Louder Than Bombs compilation was the first compilation album to be released in the United States by the band. And thus, it wound up being a double album, as this album was generally meant to substitute both for the World Won't Listen album that had been released in Britain, as well as the previous Hatfield of Hollow compilation album that had been released in Britain several years earlier. Essentially, Louder Than Bombs was a collection of all of the singles and B-sides by the Smiths that had been released, but most of which had not been included on the American versions of the Smiths' albums. And thus, that large collection wound up resulting in Louder Than Bombs being a double album. Due to the many B-side songs that were on this album that weren't on any of the Smiths' main albums, Louder Than Bombs also became so popular as an import back into the UK that the band's record company eventually relented and released this compilation album in Britain as well, even though the album had originally been intended to simply fill the gaps in the band's catalog for their growing American fan base. Louder Than Bombs really is the perfect entry point for any new fan exploring the Smiths catalog for the first time, as I was really doing at this time. Louder Than Bombs displayed the full story of the Smiths, from their first ever single, Hand in Glove, and then the album continued, as I noted, running through all of the band's singles and B-sides, clear up to the band's first two singles of 1987. Which were Shoplifters of the World Unite and the very catchy Sheila Take a Bow.
How can someone so young sing words so sad? Sheila take a bow. Boot the grime of this world in the crush, dear. And don't go home tonight. Come out and find the one that you love and who loves you.
Louder Than Bombs didn't contain How Soon Is Now, because the band's record label had actually added that song to the American version of the album Meat Is Murder, and Louder Than Bombs didn't contain any of the songs off the newly released Strange Ways Here I Come album. In truth, I still probably listen to Louder Than Bombs far more than I ever do Strange Ways Here I Come, but I tend to be resistant towards placing compilation albums on my top 20 lists if there is a good studio album by the band to celebrate instead, as in the case here. So, as I noted, the song Girlfriend in a Coma was in heavy rotation on MTV in 1987. However, if anything, the presence of Girlfriend in a Coma probably held this album back from placing higher in my top 20 than I've placed it here. Girlfriend in a Coma is the type of novelty song that is amusing after the first few times you hear it, but it's not necessarily the kind of song that stands up to long-term repeated listening. Strange Ways Here I Come shows a band that had gotten tired of their established musical formula. And guitarist Johnny Marr, who composed most of the band's music, spends this album experimenting with other musical textures beyond the jangle pop sort of backgrounds that he had favored on the band's previous albums. And the production of the album is filled out with lush synth simulations of saxophones and strings. And the band uses drum machine rhythms for the first time on this album. Beyond the dark humor of Girlfriend in a Coma, a lot of Strange Ways Here I Come is perhaps the most dark and lonely music from a band already known for their songs of isolation and angst. This song cycle culminates in the absolutely brilliantly harrowing odyssey of sad desperation in the song Last Night I Dreamt That Somebody Loved Me.
Last night I dreamt that somebody loved me. No hope, no harm, just another false alarm.
This song was the third of three singles that were released from Strange Ways Here I Come, and it wound up being a minor hit in the UK. Girlfriend in a Coma was the album's best charting single, having gone to number 13 in England. The second single from the album was the song I Started Something I Couldn't Finish, which was a mid-tier English hit as well. And then the fourth single from the album was Stop Me If You've Heard This One Before. And this song did not become a hit at all, which is surprising to me because the song is actually pretty catchy.
Stop me, oh, oh, stop me. Stop me if you think that you've heard this one before. Stop me, oh, oh, stop me. Stop me if you think that you've heard this one before. Nothing's changed. I still love you. Oh, I still love you. Only slightly, only slightly less than I used to, my love.
After recording this album, Johnny Marr took a break from the band, and he began to do work with other people in order to further explore some new musical ideas. The band singer, Morrissey, felt that this was a betrayal, and due to the feud between the two band members, the band wound up falling apart over this disagreement. Initially, the Smiths attempted to move forward with a new guitar player, but the initial musical recordings from that endeavor have never been released, and the band officially broke up in 1987, shortly before Strange Ways Here I Come had gotten released. Given that one of the issues leading to the band's demise was Morrissey's refusal to accept Johnny Marr working on music outside of the confines of the Smiths, it is a bit ironic that the final song on this final Smiths album was the song I Won't Share You.
I won't share you. With the drive and ambition, the zeal I feel, this is my time. The note I wrote as she read, she said, has the Perrier gone straight to my head? Or is life sick and cruel instead?
My number 17 favorite album of 1987 was from Sonic Youth, and that album was titled Sister. Sister was Sonic Youth's fourth album, and the album featured the band solidifying their new direction that they had begun on their previous album, with the band developing their sound into more coherent song structures. Sonic Youth had begun their career as part of the experimental no wave scene in New York, which celebrated noisy dissonance and atonality, and took a very free jazz type of approach to playing music that focused on avoiding the established cliches of most rock and pop music. But Sonic Youth had begun creating more deliberately composed song structures with their 1986 album, Evil. The developments that Sonic Youth was accomplishing at this point with their music would soon lead to the genius of their follow-up album, Daydream Nation, an album which is among my favorite albums of all time. But on this album, Sister, Sonic Youth wasn't quite there yet. But the resulting music on this album still has a lot of the epic wall of noise majesty that I love about the band, while also still coalescing into actual songs. For Sister, Sonic Youth helped to focus that songwriting effort by creating a loose sort of concept album. The album was inspired by the life and writings of science fiction author Philip K. Dick. The title of this album, Sister, as well as the lyrics within the song Schizophrenia, were both references to Philip K. Dick's twin sister, who had died shortly after birth. On this album, there are still bursts of complete noise rock, such as the song White Cross. But Sonic Youth also explored more melodic, acoustic guitar songs on this album, such as the song Beauty Lies in the Eye. And the band on this album found a fascinating middle ground between those two extremes on songs such as Pacific Coast Highway, which balances out the noise within a fairly conventional song structure. And to me, this song is the best indicator on this album of the absolute brilliance that Sonic Youth would finally fully achieve on that Daydream Nation album to come.
Come on, get in the car.
My number 16 favorite album of 1987 is by my all-time favorite band, The Grateful Dead, and the album was In the Dark.
Thank you.
plenty of old-school deadheads that resent In the Dark due to the influx of new, mostly young people that were drawn into the scene by the success of this album. There were problems in the scene managing this new crowd, and due to the various shenanigans from the less evolved members of the new crowd, the band wound up soon finding itself evicted from some of the fabulous and favored venues that they had been using earlier in the 1980s, including being thrown out of Red Rocks in Colorado, and the Frost Theater, and the Greek Amphitheater in the band's native Bay Area. At this point, the Grateful Dead began its transition to larger corporate stadiums in order to handle the new crowd sizes they were drawing. So there definitely was some strong pushback from established fans of the band against this sudden influx of new fans that didn't always seem to be there primarily for the music. And this discomfort with changes to the long-established Deadhead scene was also underlined by the odd fact that, for the first time in the Grateful Dead's career, the band had released a successful pop single with the song Touch of Grey, which wound up getting this new crowd the term Touchheads.
Sorry that you feel that way. The only thing there is to say, every silver lining's got a touch of gray.
So, as I noted, it isn't unusual to hear a lot of those old-time fans of the band that actively hated this album due to that influence. But, in truth, In the Dark is one of the Dead's best ever studio albums. It was the band's first new studio album in 7 years. And so most of the songs on the album, for the most part, had been played for quite a number of years, so the songs were well road-tested. With this well-honed song cycle of established songs, the band for once was able to use the studio effectively to capture and highlight the strength of each of the songs on the album, including that tuneful pop earworm potential that Touch of Grey had always had, and that helped to make that song the surprise hit of the year when it became the Grateful Dead's only top 40 hit of their history. And in fact, Touch of Grey wound up going all the way up to number 9, and it was the number 1 song on rock radio charts. But this pop success wasn't any sort of clever calculation by the band. They really had no reason to know that Touch of Grey would be such a massive breakthrough to mainstream culture for them. The song Touch of Grey had been in regular rotation for 5 years by the time the song was finally recorded and released as the lead single for this album. The album also contains Hell in a Bucket, which the band had been playing since 1983. Hell in a Bucket became a popular song for the band to often kick off sets with. And while this song didn't hit the pop charts, it was another one that did well on rock radio, where it went to number 3 on those charts.
Never mind, I stumble and fall. Never mind, I stumble and fall. You imagine me slipping, camping in your food, when I taste your elegant pie. I may be going to hell in a bucket, babe, but at least I'm enjoying the ride. I'm enjoying the ride. Yeah, at least I'm enjoying the ride. Yeah.
The song West LA Fade Away was said to be a tribute to the late John Belushi, and that song wound up being the album's 3rd single. It also just managed to squeeze in to the bottoms of the rock charts.
Didn't want to be mean about it, but I didn't have one good word to say. West LA fade away. Little red light on the highway, big green light on the speedway.
fourth single from the album was the politically toned Throwing Stones. Throwing Stones is one of those great sort of protest songs that works well and universally by keeping its political points broad and timeless, rather than making them overly topical to a specific event or era. Throwing Stones wound up going to number 15 on the rock charts.
With a rich man in his summer home, she can just leave well enough alone. But his pants are down, his cover's blown. When the politicians throwing stones, so the kids they dance and shake their bones, cause it's all too clear we're on our own. Singing ashes, ashes all fall down, ashes, ashes all fall down. Picture a bright blue ball just spinning, spinning free.
All this radio success propelled In the Dark to double platinum sales status and elevated it to be the highest charting album of the Grateful Dead's career, with the album climbing to number 6 on the Billboard charts. That made for 4 of the 7 songs on the vinyl version of this album becoming hits. The other 3 songs on the album were all strong deep cuts as well, with 2 of them being Garcia Hunter songs. The song When Push Comes to Shove and Black Muddy River. Black Muddy River would wind up being the final song that Jerry Garcia sang at the final Dead show before his death in 1995, though it wasn't the final song by the band because they followed up that song with Phil Lesh's Box of Rain. So Black Muddy River was the second to the last song that the entire band ever played.
Walk alone by the black muddy river and sing me a song of my own. I will walk alone by the black muddy river and sing me a song of my own.
Then the 7th song on this album was the rare song to be released with keyboard player Brent Midland on vocals. And it was one of Midland's best ever original songs, the song Tons of Steel. I personally think that Tons of Steel could have been another rock radio hit if the band had bothered to actually release the song as a single.
900,000 tons of steel.
An extra deep cut that was not found on the vinyl version of In the Dark, but was included as a bonus track on cassette versions of the album, was the song My Brother Esau. My Brother Esau has long been one of my favorite of the more obscure deep cut Dead songs. My Brother Esau was a Weir Barlow song that was only played live during the mid-1980s. The song first appeared in concert in 1983. And the song would never be played again for some reason after 1987. It's a great song with a typical sort of strange structure to it, like a lot of the Weir songs from this era had. I'm not quite sure why it fell out of favor with the band, but I'll play a clip of that song now as a last sample from this outstanding Grateful Dead album.
Esau skates on mirrors. Yet sometimes at night I dream he's still that hairy man, shadow boxing the apocalypse, wandering the land.
Next up is my number 15 favorite album of 1987, and it was from Lyle Lovett, and the album was Pontiac.
If I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean, and if I had a pony, ride him on my boat, and we could all together go out on the ocean, set me up on my pony, on my boat. Now if I were Roy Rogers, I'd sure enough be single. I couldn't bring myself to marry an old dame.
Pontiac was Lyle Lovett's second album of his career. But it was really this second album that properly introduced Lyle Lovett's musical vision to the world. His debut album, the prior year, had proven that Lyle Lovett was a gifted songwriter and an effective and engaging singer. But it was on Pontiac that Lovett began showing the world just how original and singular his musical vision really was. For this album, Lyle Lovett seems to fuse country folkiness with the odd hipster wit of Mose Allison-style jazz and blues on songs such as She's No Lady.
She loves to lie beside me almost every night. Well, she's no lady, she's my wife. The preacher asked her, and she said, I do. The preacher asked me, and she said, yes, he does too. The preacher said, I pronounce you 99 to life. Son, she's no lady, she's your wife.
There's still plenty of Roadhouse Country flair to be found on the album, though. But even on those songs, there are sly bits of originality that avoid a lot of the expected Nashville cliches.
So I stopped off this little cowboy-looking bar, walked on through the door, and she just smiled. Well, then a long ponytail and a pretty white dress. She said, hi, bull riders do it best. I said, oh my God, what's your name? My name's Lyle. And I said, ooh, give back my heart, you pick a redneck woman. Take your boots and walk out of my life. And I said, ooh, give back my heart, you pick a redneck woman. I can't be no cowgirl paradise.
Lyle Lovett proves himself equally capable of delivering a song of childlike innocence with If I Had a Boat, which was the first song that I played during this segment, and then later, on the same album, delivering a poetic character sketch of an old man with troubled dark memories, which is the album's title song, Pontiac.
Girl there across the street, she said so. Girl there across the street, she sits on the front porch swing. She never realized what I told her with my eyes. I'm back in the second floor, I cooked one in general with my own bed.
Pontiac is a tour de force of songwriting that to me showed Lyle Lovett as being the natural heir to the clever and idiosyncratic songwriting of John Prine. Though in Lyle Lovett's case, he was able to gain a bit of a foothold in mainstream country music, at least at this start of his career. The Nashville establishment soon soured on Lyle Lovett's unwillingness to cater to their formulas. Much like his debut album, Pontiac was able to score a number of moderate hits on country radio at the time, with the song that I already played, She's No Lady, being the biggest hit from the album, going to number 13 on the country charts. And another song I already played, Give Me Back My Heart, going to number 17. The other hit on the album that I haven't played yet was the song I Loved You Yesterday, which went to number 24.
I could tell you, you would just let me through. I could tell you, because I know I loved you yesterday, and I love you just the same. And none of the things you do could tear us apart. I loved you yesterday, and I love you just the same. When I gave myself to you, you took only my heart.
For Lovett's follow-up album after Pontiac, he would put together a large band to play more jazz-tinged western swing music, and that wound up simply being a bridge too far at the time for the country music establishment. So Pontiac would be the final one of Lyle Lovett's career to get any real play on country music radio stations. Past this point in his career, Lyle Lovett's music would instead become embraced by the emerging new AAA radio format, which stood for Adult Album Alternative. Still, while Lyle Lovett may have had a hard time finding regular airplay on the increasingly unimaginative radio formats of the time, he did succeed in connecting himself with a dedicated cult fan base, which helped to make Pontiac the first of five consecutive albums from Lovett to all gain gold-level sales status. So even without the support of radio hits, Lyle Lovett kept his record company quite happy with him with a flow of steady record sales.
She's got a ruby lips and emerald eyes. She's got diamonds on her mind. If you want that girl, what you need is a M-O-N-E-Y.
And now, my number 14 favorite album of 1987, which was from the Los Angeles punk band X. And the album was See How We Are.
I said, oh, really? What's this one's name? She said his first name's Homeboy.
I said, there's last name in trouble.
Founding guitar player Billy Zoom had left X the previous year, and he was originally replaced with Dave Alvin, formerly of the Blasters. Alvin's more melodically focused style helps to propel this album's most famous song, which was The 4th of July. This was a song which Dave Alvin himself wrote for the band, and which has become one of X's most recognizable songs, though the song was never actually a hit.
On the stairs I smoke a cigarette alone. Mexican kids I shoot, fireworks below. And hey, baby, at the 4th of July. Hey, baby, at the 4th of July.
It's interesting to me that it took an infusion of new ideas from Dave Alvin to help X reconnect with the simplicity and the immediacy that punk rock music is generally known for. After a number of albums by X, on which the band seemed to lose itself a bit in pursuing more artsy songwriting ideas. As it turned out, Dave Alvin wasn't willing to join the band on a full-time basis. And so this album also features tracks with Tony Gilkison on guitar, who would become the band's full-time lead guitar player for the tour in support of this album, although Dave Alvin did appear on some live dates with the band during this era as well. Tony Gilkison's style has some similar influences to it as Billy Zoom's had had, so he fit X's traditional sound perhaps a little bit better than Dave Alvin actually did.
All the lights go out, evenings go on and on. The sun goes down and I'm too lost to ever, ever be found. I'm lost, sleeping in the alley. I'm lost, heads of family. I'm lost, out here.
X works with a new producer for this album, that producer being Alvin Clark. Clark brought in a more polished production style to this project than the band's prior albums had had.
Surprise, surprise, there's a band on stage. Surprise, surprise, I'm in a bar. Surprise, surprise.
All in all, the results of this album, to me, make it the second best X album of their career, surpassed only by the amazing debut album, Los Angeles, that the band had released back in 1980. Let's listen to one more track off this album. This song is In the Time It Takes.
In the time it takes to pay my hotel bill,
for my number 13 favorite album of 1987, we go to the 70s prog masters Jethro Tull, who delivered one of their all-time best albums deep into the 1980s, when prog music really wasn't thriving at all. The album was Crest of a Knave, and it was an album which is also infamous and widely reviled due to its upset win in the 1989 Grammy Awards, when it edged out Metallica's 1988 album, And Justice for All, for the new Grammy category of Best Hard Rock or Metal Performance, Vocal or Instrumental. To this day, music fans still complain about Jethro Tull winning an award for making metal music, when they obviously aren't a metal band. But most of these people seem to forget that hard rock at the time was part of that award category as well, and Jethro Tull definitely were playing hard rock, as that genre had long been defined. And this album was totally worthy to win an award in a hard rock category. In fact, Crest of a Knave might just be the most guitar-focused album of Jethro Tull's career, especially with songs like Steel Monkey, which contains none of the typical flute work of Ian Anderson that Jethro Tull is most famous for.
Guess what I am? I'm a steel monkey. Now some men hustle, some just think.
After Jethro Tull had achieved a bunch of gold and some platinum albums from 1969 to 1979, Crest of a Knave stands as the band's only really successful album of the 1980s. And it was the band's last album to ever achieve gold sales level status. Three songs from Crest of a Knave got significant airplay on American rock radio, including the Steel Monkey song I already played. The biggest song to come off this album was the song Farm on the Freeway, which went to number 7 on the rock radio charts.
Now they might give me compensation, that's not what I'm chasing. I was a rich man before yesterday. Now all I've got is a check and a pickup truck, and I left my farm on the freeway.
The third single from the album was Jumpstart, which went to number 12 on the rock charts, and a fourth single was released from the album, but that song didn't wind up being picked up for radio play. That single was She Said She Was a Dancer.
She said she was a dancer, if I believed it, it was my business. She surely knew a thing or two about control. Next to the bar we hit the samovar. She almost slipped right through my fingers. It was snowing outside and in her soul. Well, maybe you're a dancer.
Singer Ian Anderson, at the time, was coming off a 3-year hiatus that had been caused due to a throat infection and a throat surgery to deal with the issue. this surgery resulted in changes to Ian's vocal range. But he wound up finding interesting ways to deliver the songs on this album within the new vocal range that he had at the time. And it seems like perhaps Anderson was a bit more focused due to these limitations, and that focus helped to make this song suite connect better with listeners than most of the band's other 80s albums had been able to achieve. Jethro Tull at the time was down to just a trio, and so they used synth programming, mostly done by Ian Anderson, and some of it done by guitar player Martin Baer. Martin Baer has stated that Crest of a Nave was the album on which he had probably provided the most musical ideas of the band's career. And as I noted and demonstrated with the song Steel Monkey, this album had much more of a guitar focus than most of the previous Jethro Tull albums had shown. But despite these contributions, Martin Baer also has acknowledged that Ian Anderson still had very fixed ideas on what he wanted this album to sound like. And there were still plenty of songs on the album with a more typical traditional Jethro Tull style to them, such as this song, Budapest. In addition to his flute contributions and vocals, Ian Anderson also plays acoustic and electric guitars, percussion, keyboards, synths, and does some of the drum programming on various tracks for this album. After the controversy at the 1989 Grammy Awards, the Grammy organization divided up metal music and hard rock into separate categories the following year. But again, while I, for one, do agree that And Justice for All from Metallica is an overall superior piece of musical art than Crest of a Nave, I do not in any way agree that it was some sort of travesty for Crest of a Nave to win a Grammy Award, and specifically for it to win a Grammy for being a great hard rock music album. My number 12 favorite album of 1987 was From the Call, and the album was Into the Woods. Well, it could have been me, living in that house, with all those rooms, with all that power, that powerful brain, with lighter influence. It could have been me, oh, it could have been me. Into the Woods was the fifth album from The Call, which was a band out of Santa Cruz, California. Into the Woods didn't have the sizable hits of the band's prior album, which had included the hit song I Still Believe, which also got an extra boost from being on the soundtrack of the movie The Lost Boys. And the album definitely didn't have the kind of hits that the band's following album 2 years later would have. That album would contain the song Let the Day Begin, which wound up being their biggest pop hit, going to number one on rock radio and number five on the alternative music charts. And that song even bubbled under the pop charts a little bit at number 55. However, even without those kind of hits, to me, Into the Woods is still what I believe is the band's best overall end-to-end work. And it contains what is actually my own personal favorite song from The Call, which was also the only single that was released from the album. And that song was I Don't Wanna. In here to tell you. I Don't Wanna just squeezed into the very bottom of the rock charts at number 38. The Call is a very 80s sounding band, with the trademark big anthemic and atmospheric sound that made them a bit of an American version of U2's sound, only without the massive levels of fame and success that U2 had.
Somewhere between pain and pleasure, the day goes by. Somewhere between word and action, the day goes by. You can try me without witness.
The Call never goes for easy earworm hooks on this album. Instead, the band favored moody soundscapes and introspective lyrics. The band delivers, perhaps, their most complete group collaboration on the outstanding and overlooked song, The River.
From my mother's arms, I was cruelly torn, and they whipped my ass on the day I was born. Little brother, he died.
There is also an outstanding breadth of musical expression on this album, ranging from the plaintive ballad of Memory. And that breadth then extending to the melodic drive of The Woods.
I can see night in the daytime, into the woods I quietly go. It takes all the strength I have in me. These are the woods, the night of the soul.
And after the many moody songs on this song cycle, the album winds up letting the listeners off from the emotional journey with an upbeat bit of fun to end the album with the song Walk Walk. Paul seems to be fading off into obscurity as time goes by, which is a bit of a shame, because they were really a great band. And though they were never megastars, The Call had gained enough of a cultural foothold with their 1989 hit, Let the Day Begin, that a decade later after that song was first put out, it wound up getting used as the theme song for Al Gore's presidential run in the year 2000. The Call took a long break during the 1990s, which was probably good because their music didn't really fit in with the grunge era. But the band did have a short reunion during the late 90s, which resulted in one more album from them. And then the band stopped again after the year 2000. The band's lead singer, Michael Biehn, died of a heart attack in 2010. There have been a couple of reunions since that time, including a few shows that have featured Michael Biehn's son, Robert Levin Biehn, on vocals. Robert is also the lead singer for the popular band Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. But without Michael Biehn, it seems unlikely that the call will ever really make a cultural comeback. And that fade-off into obscurity that I mentioned does seem inevitable. Not every great rock band is destined to become long-term legends. But whatever the fate of this band, none of it diminishes just how good they were during their peak of creativity. And now, my number 11 favorite album of 1987, which was from Spaceman 3. Spaceman 3 was a neo-psychedelic band from the middle of England, out of the town of Rugby in the West Midlands county of Warwickshire. Their 1987 album was The Perfect Prescription. And this was the band's second album, with their debut album having come out the previous year. Though Spaceman 3 wasn't from the Manchester scene, which was about to become the nexus of the Second Summer of Love, there is no doubt that the psychedelic drug advocacy of the members of Spaceman 3 was a very influential catharsis for that emerging new scene. Indeed, the Perfect Prescription album was a concept album based around the concept of following the story of a drug trip from initial ingestion of the unnamed drug. And the song cycle follows the ebb and flow, the ups and downs of the experience. Through the first half of this album, the music becomes increasingly more lush and serene, leading to the fourth song of the album, Ecstatic Symphony. That sets the mood as the climactic high of the trip sets in. The fifth song of the album is Transparent Radiation, which was a cover of a song originally recorded by a band named Red Crayola. Red Crayola was a 60s Texas psychedelia band.
Selfless man slept by my side, uttering words about the turning tide, and she slowly furnishes my continuous ride towards insanity. Red bits of pine, hair quite long and lavender dyed, split nostrils hungry, open wide.
Transparent Radiation represented the mental odyssey as the drug ingester rides the waves of the high that they have achieved. And then, after this, over the second half of the album, the inevitable come down begins. And by the eighth track, the trippy part of the album concludes with the song Come Down Easy. However, there is also a cautionary coda to this album, with the ninth and final song, which seems to indicate that this particular intense drug trip has resulted in an overdose. And thus, the album ends with the song Call the Doctor.
I don't think they'll wait and breathe.
The band Spacemen 3 went through a large number of members during its existence, but the two consistent creative forces for the group were Peter Kemper and Jason Pierce. These two co-produced this album, and they both play guitars and they both sing, and Jason Pierce also played keyboards for the album. Pete Basin played bass for this album and for the group's debut album. And for this album, the group had a drummer at the time who simply went by the stage name of Roscoe. But much of this album did not actually feature many drum rhythms on it. The Perfect Prescription didn't really get much notice at first in England, but it did get a little bit of support by US-based college radio stations. However, partly as a result of the influence of the ecstasy-fueled Second Summer of Love, and even more due to the popularity of the band Spiritualized, which would later be formed by Jason Pierce after the breakup of Spacemen 3, this band had a late surge in critical recognition and musical influence, just at the point when the band was actually beginning to fall apart as a creative partnership. It was really only in the years after the breakup of the band that people seemed to really appreciate just how good this band had been at their peak. And that peak is represented by this particular excellent album. This entry is going to end this episode. Join me again next episode as I reveal my ultimate top 10 favorite albums of 1987. As always, if you want to get a hold of me, you're welcome to send email to tony@roadtojamnation.com, or you can join my Facebook group called Road to Jam Nation and leave any comments or questions there, or I can also be found at Twitter under my actual name of Tony Kurilic. Now, let's end off this episode with one more selection off The Perfect Prescription. This song is Feels So Good. Enjoy!